Well, welcome to the Luke Macias Show. For a lot of you who listen to and watch this podcast, you are coming to San Antonio. I will welcome you to the city that I live in a couple weeks to attend the Republican State Convention, which is the second largest political gathering in the world. Okay. The largest is the CCP's convention, which isn't really a convention. Like, everybody shows up, they already know what's going to happen. That's what it's like if you live in the CCP. So we might be the largest actual political gathering in the world. And I wanted to have a conversation with Chairman Matt Rinaldi, who's not running for re-election, but has served our party for 3 years. Many of you know and have watched the work he's done. And I think it's really going to be valuable to pull the curtain back and talk about where the party's at today compared to previous, the last several decades of where the Republican Party has been, even parties as a whole, how they work and operate, as you all prepare to come to San Antonio and make some decisions on what the party should do moving forward. So with that, let's get to the show. Thank you for joining us today, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
3 years ago, several people started talking to you about the idea of running for chairman of the Republican Party of Texas, a decision you decided to go forward with. This was not something, I think it's important for kind of people to understand that this isn't a position that you envisioned yourself being in. You've been involved in politics for a long time. So tell us kind of the thought process behind why you even decided to run for chair.
Well, I'd been in the legislature for 4 years, and then I had been out of the legislature at that time for just a little over 2 years, but it still remained active in politics, and trying to influence policy. And somebody broached the idea of running for party chair, and I saw an opportunity to help our movement, our conservative movement here in the state of Texas, specifically because party organizations all over the country are not fulfilling their potential, and we weren't here either. Generally, I think you hear the establishment group of people try to sell the grassroots that parties are there to raise money and win elections in November, and that's it. Well, no. Parties historically in our nation's history, for most of our nation's history, had a very important policy role. They were the party faithful, the party members set the policies and principles that guided the elected officials that used their brand once they were elected. So they would get people elected, and then they would work with elected officials to make sure that they fulfilled the principles that they ran on. Here in Texas, I saw the opportunity to make the party fulfill that role again. And that's what we work to do.
So when you were a state representative, the party during your time in the legislature, you served under Speaker Strauss.
Yes.
The party didn't put a lot of pressure on Speaker Strauss, somebody who we knew at the time was holding up a lot of Republican policy. Do you feel like that in any way kind of changed your perspective on how you could see the party engage based on how you wish the party would have engaged while you were in the legislature?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the party, when I was in the legislature, didn't speak on those important issues. So it wasn't really relevant when we were in discussions, when we were in negotiations, when we were planning strategy. And that was a problem, right? I mean, when the party disempowers itself, who is empowered? The people who are in those conversations. And that's money, special interests, corporations. And they're not guided by principles like the party is. They're guided by self-interest. They're guided by money issues. When you see the rise of the uniparty in our country and the establishment in the past, you know, 50 to 100 years, that coincides almost exactly with the decline in the power of political parties. And I think we need to know that there's causation.
So parties historically have had the platform. Like, we've always had the Republican Party platform. I feel like since I showed up to my first convention at 16 years old, people were saying this is the most robust party platform in the country. Other parties in other states say, hey, we use y'all's platform as kind of a base for ours. It's a very thick document that covers a ton of different issues. But to your point, Republican parties in the past haven't been active in basically their role is like, we're going to work on this platform. We're going to really be really proud of the platform. But if none of the platform actually gets accomplished, we're not that disappointed. The Democrat Party seems pretty darn set on enacting as much of its policy into law when it has the power. Republicans don't tend to do that. So can you share some of the different things you actually did over 3 years to start to change? What are the tactics that then get implemented with that kind of vision going in?
Well, at convention, there's a very specific focus on our legislative priorities and party platform, because we know over the next 2 years, it's going to actually mean something. It's going to be our marching orders. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that the party fulfilled its traditional role of private organization, self-governing organization. So in what was, I don't want to say symbolic gesture, but it didn't alter the actual rules at convention, my first convention. We succeeded. We didn't incorporate state statutes governing the party by reference. That was something where I wanted to say, no, we're governing ourselves and we choose to follow those state statutes. But if the state wants to impermissibly control the party in a way that the party does not want to be controlled in its own self-governance, we are going to resist that. And that was the first significant thing that we did. Then during legislative session, we spoke out on issues. It would be interesting because in previous administrations, even where we had legislative priorities, right? And that was initially controversial. But previous administrations would, when a legislative priority didn't get passed, we would advocate for it. But then when it got killed, they would ignore what killed it. So it was almost like they lost their car keys or something. I mean, they lost the legislative priority. What happened? I don't know. I don't even remember when the last time I saw it was. You know, no, there were specific people killing those legislative priorities. And specifically, most of the time, the vast majority of the time, that was coming in the House of Representatives with either Joe Strauss or Dennis Bonin or Dade Field. And then during the legislative session, we not only would use the party brand to communicate with Republican voters as to what was happening with those legislative priorities, we put money behind it. We spent over $400,000 during the legislative session and the special sessions communicating with voters in targeted districts about what was actually happening in the legislature. And we'd never done that before. Usually, you know, you would, as a Republican, get communications during election time.
Yep.
Well, then it was noisy. It was hard to break through. But during session, now they were hearing from their party as to what was happening. And as you can judge from what happened on March 5th, yep, I don't think a lot of people were very happy about it.
You hear a lot of the politicians complaining about this, right? They complain, hey, we wanted more of that money for when we were running so people could vote for us. And then regardless of what we accomplished in policy, and when I say politicians, we haven't heard senators, any the statewides have not complained about the party, but it's more specifically the leadership team around Dade Phelan has lobbed this accusation. We're mad that you didn't tell more people we were awesome and to send us here, and that you then spent money telling voters and our constituents that we needed to pass certain policies that we all campaigned on. So you mentioned separating the part, meaning removing all of these codes. And that was actually this kind of behind the scenes battle, right? Mm-hmm. That went on because nobody wanted to stand up at the last convention and say, hey, we really want to be tied and dictated to by all the elected officials. Nobody had that position, but there were all of these phone calls getting made behind the scenes. And then there was motion on the floor. People were saying, maybe we just delay the whole thing so the rules never pass, because if the rules never pass, we'll revert back to the old rules, and those all have state statute in them. So I want to kind of break this down for people to understand, and then I want to look at this last session, what Dustin Burrows did. So there was all this scuttle. There were people trying to delay. The idea was if we don't pass any rules during the convention, we'll revert back to the old rules, which has all these state statutes. And your position and other people on the Rules Committee have basically just said, we're an independent association. We don't need to be dictated to by the legislature. That's a bad precedent to set. We're taking these steps to do this. Fast forward, you know, some people go, often they say conservatives are, you know, searching, it's like a solution in search of a problem. But I think that when you fast forward to the next legislative session, Dustin Burrows ends up taking action to basically quasi defund the Republican Party of Texas. I want you to explain to people that bill, what it did, and why the party took an active role against it.
So, yeah, the Dustin Burroughs bill, by the way, it follows last session, the bill where they tried to make the chairman of the Republican Party not elected by delegates at the convention.
We'll get there in a second. To be elected. And SREC members.
And SREC members to be elected in primaries.
Let's get there actually before we get there, because I actually think that's great. So was that also a Burroughs bill or was that somebody else? Was that Vassut's bill?
Vassut.
Yeah. So Vassut's bill ends up saying SREC members and the chair should be elected statewide. And practically speaking, what this does is you have somebody running for this like random position where the delegates are the like these are the active members of the Republican Party of Texas. Instead, they want to be able to have like lobbyists, TLR, ART, all these groups spend a ton of money electing some random person to a board position on the Republican Party of Texas.
Right.
And then this person's elected with all this lobby money that got spent to elect them. And then they get to dictate. So this was their way to say, everyone who shows up, like anybody who's watching this or listening to this that shows up at convention and then makes governing decisions there. This was the political class saying, we don't want y'all to make the governing decisions of the RPT. We actually want to be able to use lobby money to flood all these statewide Republican primaries and then elect the governing boards ourselves.
Right. It was a government takeover of the Republican Party. And it goes back to that. Who sets the principles that define what a political party is? Is it the candidates or is it the political party? The political party focuses generally on actual principles and values like you find in the platform. When the candidates set those principles, it's either based on moneyed interests, special interest groups that fund their campaigns, or just personal things between candidates where you have these campaigns now that focus on not policy, but just personal attacks and personalities. So, but that was a government takeover of the Republican Party structure in the state of Texas.
So Burroughs files a bill having to do with determining if the party determines a candidate is not qualified. So
correct.
Explain that, because again, that sounds real nuanced, but I think when people understand what the goal of the bill was, then they'll understand why you even took the steps a year before to start removing state statutes.
So what Burroughs is scared about, I think he's a very smart person, so he probably knows this, that several state parties across the United States, some of them, I believe, got this power through the judicial system by asserting it, have the power to reject applications for places on the ballot for whatever reason they want to. I think in like Tennessee, Robbie Starbuck, who ran for Congress, was one person who got his ballot rejected by a party, and Robbie was a grassroots guy, but it works the other way too when the grassroots hold the party.
Yeah, so to be clear, this isn't a conservative versus, this is just an idea of the party versus the elected class kind of, or
correct,
the politician.
The people running for office. It was a party power. So I think with Dade Phelan abusing his power, attacking the party like never before, I think they were worried that we were going to reject Dade Phelan's position for place on the ballot to identify as a Republican. So what they said was, if the party rejects an application for place on the ballot and it wasn't supported by law, the state party loses all of its primary funding, which is approximately $700,000 to $1 million to conduct the primary election.
And can you explain why there is state funding for primaries, how that works?
It generally works because of the state running the elections. The state, we have to return. Well, what happens is the state gets filing fees.
Yeah.
And instead of the party keeping those filing fees, the state says, well, we'll run the elections. If you don't have enough filing fees to run the election, we'll give you the money to do it. If you have too much, you have to return it to
the party,
the Secretary of State.
Okay.
So we get about $700,000 to run our primary. We probably spend around $200,000 of it, and then we return the remainder to the Secretary of State. A county party probably won't get that much in filing fees, so the Secretary of State subsidizes them.
Got it. Okay. So this is to make sure the elections get run. It's actually mostly covered through these filing fees that are coming in from candidates at the local level.
Which are ours anyway, by the way. We're voluntarily participating in this system.
So Burroughs says, if you reject anyone, if somebody tries to file and you reject them and say, this person doesn't meet the qualifications, if this law passes, unless you can have a state statute that says you can reject them, then you lose all the money that actually, for the most part, came to the party first, went to the, like, it's your money that the SOS has, but It's designed to basically say we're afraid that we're not passing all this Republican legislation. Yeah. We're killing dozens of Republican bills. We're worried that the party seems to actually be kind of understanding that it can assert its authority and power over us, and we just want to close that door.
Yeah.
This bill is like filed, hearing the next day, on the floor a week later. I remember when it was on the floor talking to different state representatives on the floor, and they're all going, I don't know what's happening. I'm not trying.
A lot of them are like, I like this idea.
Yeah.
You can't, okay.
You can't kick me off the ballot?
Can't kick me off the
Great.
Ballot. We're good. but then we sent out, I'd sent out a notification to all of the 254 county chairs that should this bill pass, I believe the penalties would be so strong for even inadvertently rejecting a place, an application for place on the ballot for a reason like they filled out the form wrong.
Yep.
They didn't give the required petition signatures.
Yep.
They didn't pay.
Yeah, because you will reject. Like if some guy shows up with an application to run for constable but doesn't give any money, you reject that filing because you're like, you don't have the fee. Or, hey, you submitted via petition signatures. Oh, you don't have the signatures. They're met. Oh, you just go through a laundry list.
Right.
So you can look at this application, deny it, and yet they're going, no, we don't want to do that. The goal of the borough's bill being to assert the state over the party, right?
Right.
He wants the state over the party. And I think this maybe helps the average person understand. You came in and put the party over the state, and then Burrow's almost, it was like the, it's like the baseball bat game where you do this, right? So you come in and go here, the Burrow's is like, I want to go here. And then you're like, nope, we're not going to do that. So that bill dies in the Texas Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this maybe is one thing worth understanding. A lot of people I've heard, and the grassroots I talk to are like, we love the new approach the party takes. And then the criticism you hear from the more moderate side of the party is, well, I think it'd be good if we had party leadership that actually got along with our elected officials. So I think this is a good opportunity to talk about how do you feel like the party gets along with the Senate, our statewide elected officials, our Republicans in U.S. Congress, all of those type of individuals? Because when the moderates say, I think the party needs to get along better with the elected officials, they're really just talking about Dade Phelan's state representatives, in my opinion. But nobody would say that. Nobody's going to run and say, I want the party to have a better relationship with Dade Phelan's lieutenants and him. So what do you feel like, honestly, from the party chair's position, the party's relationship is with the rest of the elected officials outside of Dade Phelan's friends?
I think it's better than it's been in any recent memory. Because if you remember during the Tea Party movement, and even before the Tea Party movement, do you remember the massive dissatisfaction with elected officials that the party was showing constantly? You had these battles over whether or not we should give amnesty to illegal immigrants, and there was clashes at the party convention. And that was because the establishment ran the party and, by the way, most of the legislature and offices in the state. But, you know, now we have the party, the president, and in the GOP presidential nominee, we have the Senate, we have conservatives in the House, we have virtually all of our statewide officials and the state party and its executive committee and the delegates all on the same page. And the only outlier is Dade Phelan.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the problem here? The problem is not that we're disunified. We're more unified than ever in terms of the percentages of the party that are unified. But we have a very small group sowing discontent, attacking the party, creating disunity because they're about to lose their power. And that's what's happening.
So if candidates are running for leadership positions in the GOP and they're talking about having a better relationship with the elected officials, would you agree, like, the party doesn't have a bad relationship with elected officials outside of Dade and then anybody who's loyal to Dade?
If someone's saying that, they're implying that there are some elected officials we don't have a good relationship, who we should have a good relationship.
Yep.
Because the only elected officials who we have an adversarial relationship are Dade Phelan and his closest lieutenants, therefore they are saying we need to have a better relationship with Dade Phelan. And I don't believe we do. I think there are two ways to achieve unity. One is to compromise, and I don't think you can compromise along such a gulf that you end up giving up all your principles in order to do so. And the second thing is just to win.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we're doing. We did it on March 5th. We have a bunch of runoff elections now. I don't think Dade Phelan will be in the House next session. I think a lot of his supporters have been ousted, and a lot of the people who previously supported him truly are in the legislature, like for the right reasons, and you know, heard the voice of the people and are trying to serve their people, like Tom Oliverson, who's running against Dade Phelan. And talking about elected official relationships, by the way, when we were active during the legislative session, I want to be clear, we publicly put television ads out in Dade Phelan's district because he wouldn't talk to us. He would just attack us, right? That was the only way we could communicate with him or his constituents. So we did that. But in other areas, like, you know, the child gender modification bill, for example, you know, Tom Oliverson passed that bill. I remember I would be on the phone with Dan Patrick on that bill, and he was responsive to grassroots concerns on how that bill was drafted. And so was Tom Oliverson as well. So I would talk to Tom, I would talk to Dan Patrick, and we ended up working out a bill in the end that everybody was happy with and could support, and that did what it was intended to do. That's exactly what the party should be doing. We should be mediating policy disputes like that to ensure it comports with the values and principles of the party and its members.
You put out a statement and formed a kind of special committee to study the process of closing Republican primaries. We have a number of races. I think just from looking, I know that like Morgan Meyer's election in Dallas County, he won by less than 1%, and 3-5% of the voters there were Democrat primary voters, right? They'd voted in Democrat primaries in the past. They came over and voted in this election. We know now that Dade Phelan, who barely got out of like losing without a runoff, had close to 9% of voters. So literally close to 9% of the vote in that district was cast by Democrat primary voters, voters who voted in more Democrat primaries. There, I mean, it's very clear that Democrats like participating in the Republican primary process to elect the more liberal options. Yeah. And if you rewind back, like let's just for the sake of studying history, go back like 15 years and say for the last 15 years we had closed primaries. There are, I'm saying, dozens and dozens of Republican, liberal Republicans that would not be in the legislature because they would have lost a long time ago. So I want to hear from you that committee you created. And one of the things you said in the release was you want to look at legislative and non-legislative solutions. Talk about what that looks like.
Okay. So I authored a closed primary bill. I forgot whether I was co-author or I authored it. It was in the state legislature when I was there. So there's been an issue that's been important to me for a long time. The closed primaries benefit political parties, benefit the majority political party in states like ours. And we did see significant crossover voting that I think isn't even being quantified in districts that are rural, where Republicans win with 80% of the vote. That 20% is not voting in a Democrat primary. So I think it's far larger than 9% in a lot of districts.
Yep.
So if you polled people who consider themselves Democrats and asked if they voted the Republican primary, I think you get a lot higher number.
I just want to break that down and explain it to people what you just said. So what you're saying is if you live in a really rural area that's an 80, I mean, some of these counties are like 87% Republican.
Right.
So if you are the 13% that when you go in for the general, cast a ballot for Joe Biden or Colin Allred, that person probably doesn't vote in their Democrat primary, probably hasn't for a long time. So they might be a 3 of 4 R voter that in all reality is a Democrat, has been a Democrat for a long time. Yeah. And that person's not going to show up on any of the reports we say when we say, this person, you don't, I hear this all the time. Somebody goes, even in Texas, they'll go, I think I'm registered as a Republican. And we don't do that. You just register. There's no party affiliation. So explain kind of what you're starting as you're closing out your time as chairman.
Okay.
You're starting this process of looking at closing the primary.
So I've given up hope. I do hope that it still happens in the legislature, but I've given up hope that the legislature is going to voluntarily close the primary. There's about 40 years of jurisprudence at the Supreme Court level and in the federal courts that show that parties have a right to free association under the First Amendment to the Constitution. We have the right to determine the methods on which relating to which we choose our candidates. We have the right to exclude Democrats from choosing our candidate. Mm. And we've seen political parties by rule set the rules and the rules surrounding how they conduct their primaries and who may participate. In Connecticut in the 80s, the Republican Party wanted to open the primary and the statute required closed primaries. The Supreme Court, in a case called Tashjian, said, you have a right to free association as a party, and if you want to open your primaries, you can open your primaries. There was another case in the early 2000s where California wanted blanket primaries and the party didn't. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the party. In Idaho, about 15 years ago, or 15, 20 years ago, they closed their primaries and mm-hmm. the statute had open primaries and the federal court ruled in favor of the party. Now, there's been other areas like South Carolina tried to do it and the court ruled against them.
Yep.
But in South Carolina, they have a statute that allows the party to choose between choosing at convention your candidates or an open primary. And what the Supreme Court said is because your statute allows you a choice of a way to exclude Democrats, then that satisfies your right to free association. So what I want to do is I want the Republican Party of Texas to take up the issue. We have the right to close the primaries if we want because our statute doesn't allow us a choice. And once we do, I think the party should devote the resources to defending that choice in court should it need to.
Yep. And I'm sure if you ask most of Dade's friends, they'd say, no, please don't defend closing the primaries. Instead, spend the money electing, you know, one or two more liberal Republicans in swing districts and things like that.
That's going to be a very important issue, right? Because I've heard two of the candidates for chair right now explicitly say they would defend closed primaries should the convention choose to do it. I haven't heard it from the other three that I remember.
Yeah, Mike Garcia, Abraham George have both said they're on board with that and would defend. And the other three so far have not said where they would stand on some of the stuff you're talking
about. To me, if I'm a convention delegate, that's a deal breaker if you won't come out in favor of that.
Yep. One of the things that the kind of Austin swamp will constantly complain about with you is, oh, well, Matt does not raise enough money for the party. Okay. So can we just kind of address that and talk about it a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, we you know, we have public meetings where our treasurer's report is given, and I always make him do a comparison to previous years, going back like to Kathy Adams, right?
Yep,
it's like 10 or 15 years. And you know what? It's remarkably consistent.
Yep.
Like the party finances go up, they go down. There's a lot of variables because you're spending the money you take in.
Yep.
And we have three different accounts. So you have three different accounts going up and down.
Yep.
And what it goes is if you don't like the chair, you could take any benchmarks and compare to a point in time and pretend
say
things
bad.
Are bad.
Yeah.
And if you like the chair,
you go,
then you say it's
when you
good.
Compare it to a year ago, it's not 2 years ago. Okay, it looks bad 2 years ago, but it looks good 4 years ago or 6 years ago, right? So you just kind of pick
or,
the point
or
in time.
Dickey had a good run in 2019. So, you know, use that as a benchmark or something like that. I mean, it's remarkably consistent to the point that Steve Battisteri, one of the former chairs, and I would say something about the finances and then, you know, like, hey, we raised more than you that year. And he would go, yeah, but if you adjust for inflation, I raised more than you. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about literally numbers adjusted for inflation.
Yep.
It's remarkably consistent.
I remember there was this complaint about how at one point the RPT had all this staff and now they don't have staff. And then I looked at it and it was like, I think these are RNC people.
Yeah,
so
it was like,
how does
it said
that
something
work?
Like 53 staff members. You know, we did have 53 people who were technically on our payroll. Most of them were being directed by RNC. And RNC, as we've heard at Ronna McDaniel's tenure, has not had the funds this election to hire as much staff in key states. So they've had to winnow down the number of states they're considering in play. And after the election we had in Texas in 2022.
Yeah,
they're not considering Texas is in play as they probably did in 2020.
Yeah, so that's another
that's
thing.
That's a good
you could, sign. That's another thing you could use to basically criticize the chair is the states become more red. Therefore, the Republican National Committee does not want to put funds in to hire a bunch of employees that are technically under RPT. And now we're going to say that's a bad thing because the RNC is less worried about Texas Isn't that the point of what the chair is trying to do, is move Texas to the right? So
yeah. I mean, among the amounts we raise, our victory program has been incredibly successful. Ted Cruz's campaign has been a great partner. We have a joint fundraising committee, and I think we raised as much money for victory as of January than we did all during the election last time. So we're doing very well.
So I hear this kind of master gaslighting communication strategy from moderates every time a conservative takes over, every single time. They basically say, because we've gone back and forth various times throughout since I've been here when I was 16 years old, right? So we're going on close to two decades. And if a conservative was chair, all the moderate donors basically tell the chair, you need to be a cheerleader for all the politicians. Don't assert your power. Definitely don't talk about policy, because none of us really want this policy. And if you do that, we'll give you a bunch of money. And even if you like show up and maybe testify, just don't talk about why it died. As you pointed out, we'll keep the money coming. And then if you don't, we're not going to write you checks. And then we're going to go tell everybody you can't raise any money. So that's a very consistent strategy employed by moderate, uniparty, liberal Republican donors. Some of them aren't even Republicans, right? But they're like, look, if my money can go to basically neutering the party, I'll write a check if the right operatives tell me to write a check, because the chair is kind of staying in their lane and not talking about policy. Is that something you feel like you've also experienced during your time as chair?
Yes. I mean, very explicitly. It was it was like within a week, they like swarmed on me. I remember I had a conversation with Karl Rove about a week or two into my term. And it was his purpose of that conversation is to try to scare me that I couldn't raise enough money for convention. I remember he said, you have a $600,000 hole in your budget. Nobody's going to fill that. Like, okay, well, I'll make it work. And then it got to the point where they oversold it so much. I remember having a conversation with Dan Patrick after. He's like, how did you raise the money for the convention? That was fantastic. I was like, oh, you know, just worked hard and made it happen. No, there was never any danger of not raising money for convention. It was something that was invented in order to try to pressure me to not, you know, do what I had promised to do when I ran for chair.
I remember that the funny thing about that is you're talking about literally you've been chair for a week or two. So it's like you haven't even made a couple fundraising phone calls. You've started to line up some meetings, and immediately they're like, hey, you're not going to fill this hole. And I'm assuming they walked out of that meeting going, Matt doesn't sound like he's going to do exactly what we want him to do. So then Karl Rove just calls everybody in Austin and is like, RPT's bankrupt. They've got a hole. Yeah. They can't fill it. And they can't fill it because he's also calling and telling them, don't give them any money. Right. So don't give them any money. Also, they have a hole. Also, they can't fill it. And then you'll have more moderate members that are maybe active in the party go, oh, my gosh, we have no money. And this just becomes this.
Well, yeah.
The like self-fulfilling prophecy where they complain. Then when you have the money, they go, okay, now we're just going to look for a period of time, a year or two or three ago, even though
they manipulate the financials to make it appear like something that exactly. We you know, the big thing to look for with a party, if you want to cut through, it's very difficult to look at the financials. Look at are they covering payroll? Do they have debt? We don't have a dime of debt as our party. We haven't since I've been chair before. So we're doing incredibly well.
I interviewed James Dickey, who was chair at the time, on this podcast. We were talking about stuff, and I had voted for James, campaigned for James. And I remember that AT&T, which is the largest tax remitter in Texas,
right,
who should have a good relationship with Republicans since we're a Republican state, had sponsored the Democrat Party convention.
Right.
And not sponsored the Republican Party convention.
Correct.
Right? Like, they're like, we want to sponsor the convention of the group that like want to chop kids' genitals off, but we don't want to actually in any way participate with the Republican. So we're talking on the podcast. Well, this wasn't like public at all. And I just asked him, has AT&T sponsored the RPT convention? And he's like, no, they haven't. So this little clip gets sent around. And I remember a conversation afterwards that it was like, hey, we need to not have conversations about that in the future. Like, which I thought was incredible to show the posture of the party. Like, wait, all Dickey said was they haven't given us money and they've given the Democrats money. You'd think that's what a chair should do. And all of a sudden, everybody's mad at him. And when I say everybody, I mainly just mean the Austin insiders and establishment are mad. They're like, hey, don't talk about it. Don't bring attention to this. Instead of saying, shouldn't all of you Republicans be calling AT&T saying, why are you screwing this up? And why are you helping the Democrats and not the Republicans? Like, this is what happens when states go blue over time, is all of a sudden these big corporations start moving all blue in their political giving and not red. So it seems like this thing has happened over and over and over again.
Yes. And I've actually gotten communications from companies that have sponsored us in the past who said we were told not to give to you.
Yeah. And you never know because who told them, but somebody told them.
Somebody definitely told them. I would estimate probably 200 to 300,000. Like, we covered our last convention. We were ahead, actually.
Yes.
For our convention. But, you know, we lost probably $200,000 to $300,000 that we quantified.
Yes.
In specific donors that told us that
I've been told not to give to you. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Ultimately, for 3 years, the party has paid every bill it ever had.
Yes.
It has. This is the thing I think that the moderates in Texas hate, is that the delegates had an expectation for what the Republican Party was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted it to fight for policy. They wanted it to fight to advance the platform, the legislative priorities, engage with elected officials, have a good relationship with elected officials who are actually trying to advance conservative policy, push back against elected officials, even in our own party, who mm-hmm. are trying to thwart conservative gains. And if that happens, delegates as a whole are like, thank you for doing what I did, and please don't go bankrupt, right? In this process, I feel like you've successfully accomplished all of those things. And yet, for moderates, all they can do for 3 years is go, no money, no money, no money, yeah. no money. And all it is this massive little pot of moderate corporate sponsorships who are like, if you'll just stop talking about Republican issues, we will flood money into the coffers.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a Democrat donor who noticed this when they were living that attack. They're like, they appear to be like X under Elon Musk, leaner and more relevant than ever before.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes them mad.
It does. I mean, like, well, we did want to get leaner, right? So the party spends like $100,000 a month on payroll now. It spent like $200,000 a month, which was just on organization when I came on.
Yeah.
And most of the $100,000 we cut were these regional employees that, from all we could tell, just get paid to go to meetings.
Yep.
It wasn't having the effect we wanted for the money. So instead, we were saving money on their pay.
Yep.
And then when we needed to mobilize at election time, we used contract labor. Mm-hmm. And we'd hit the areas where we needed to hit rather than having this bloated organization.
Yeah, and this isn't anything against anybody who had a job as a regional person. You're just saying, ultimately, there's a local county party. They might have an executive director. There's the party chair. There's the SREC member in that area. All these people go to Republican clubs. They go to CEC meetings.
There's redundancies.
Yeah. Republican club I'm at, if there's a SREC member, they stand up and say, here's ways you can engage mm-hmm. in the party. Here's things you can do. You know, remember to sign up for the grassroots club or sign up here, donate to our campaign arm, whatever. Right. And all it was there, you have some employees who were doing this on top of SREC members.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm also traveling the state, which also, we do outreach to all of the individual clubs and everything too. So, I mean, that's what we did. We wanted to make sure that any money we spent, we were spending in a way that actually made a difference. And that was huge. And at the same time, we're making the party more relevant, because the idea isn't, by the way, Dade Phelan is an outlier, right?
Yep.
We did have to exert leverage because Dade Phelan decided to go to war with the party and with Republican voters. In the future, you may have disagreements, but, you know, if the party isn't willing to use its leverage when something like Speaker Phelan happens, they're going to get walked over. Mm-hmm. So now we've shown we're willing to use that leverage in the future. Hopefully the next speaker engages us, asks, on legislation, on policy, on the details of that policy, and we work through it.
Yep.
Just like we did with Tom on his bill to ban child gender modification, which was a GOP priority, and as we have been doing with Dan Patrick for so long.
Is it possible to morph from a hero into a villain? I'm Valerie Munoz. Join me as I introduce you to the most powerful lobbying group in Texas, one that started as a savior, but has become the very thing they were created to destroy. Listen now to Season 7 of Exposed, The Beast of Austin, available wherever you get podcasts.
You have made endorsements for the party, some party leadership positions. Can you tell me, like why you've decided to do that and who you're backing?
Well, I think it's important because we've changed the role of the party so greatly over the past 3 years and made it into something so unique that I'm voting for people for the party leadership positions who will continue that. And I think it helps to make it known to the other delegates who I'm supporting so that they can support it too if they, you know, they agree with the path we've taken. Just to say, there are lots of great people running, by the way. I'm not support for one candidate in a race does not necessarily indicate that the other candidates are bad in any way or that they don't support the direction we've taken the party. There are lots of fine candidates for vice chair, for example, and I don't want to imply anything by it. However, I'm voting for Abraham George for chair. I'm voting for Dorinda Randall for vice chair, and I'm voting for Debbie Georgiatos for national committee woman. The reason why you want to know? The reason why is with Abraham, I was really impressed with him when he was Collin County GOP chair. I know how hard it is to withstand the pressure when you challenge elected officials who aren't who are being openly hostile to the party. It's tough. You know, it's kind of like when, you know, and like your favorite actress or actor says something that's really based and then you're like, oh, they're going to apologize in 2 days once they get canceled. And then all of a sudden the pressure comes. They're like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. If I offended anybody.
Yep.
Like that's what you expect with county chairs who do bold things and then get backlash. And with Abraham, the I'm sorry never came. Mm-hmm. He just did more incredible stuff. And that kind of backbone demonstrated is so rare. Mm-hmm. And he can absolutely do this job. He can absolutely put up with the immense pressure you're under when you do bold things. That's why I'm supporting him for chair. Dorinda Randall is great. She was a very devoted activist, a very conservative activist who worked for conservatives like Ken Paxton, Angela Paxton, Bob Hall.
Yep. I think I met Dorinda when she was working for Bob Hall. I mean, yeah. I ran his campaign in 2014, which is the same year you won in the legislature. And she was there on the ground, very active, helping Bob, who has been one of our most consistent conservative champions in the Texas Senate.
Yes.
Probably, I would say, Bob's like an activist at heart, because even at convention, if you're coming to the first time delegate, you're going to look around and he's with everybody else, right?
He's at the mic.
That's right. Most senators are like dressed in their suits and they're, you know, at the little fundraiser, the lunch, and they're nice people. They're great people. I like a lot of our state senators. They pass a ton of great policy. But Bob Hall is like in his Texas flag shirt on the floor, making motions. I want to edit the platform. And it's because he has this heart for the party. He's a party activist before he was a senator.
Yes.
I mean, at his core. So Dorinda has been with him for a long time. Others, I mean, she's been here for a long time.
Yeah, and was president of one of the most conservative TFRW clubs in the entire state of Texas, and one of the largest too, I think it was.
Yeah.
So party activist at heart for a long time. She's been great. And Debbie Georgiatos for national committee woman. Yeah. Guys, I hate to say it, the RNC is broken. I as chair, I'm on the RNC as well. And it is absolutely 100% controlled by the establishment. Trump appointed Michael Whatley as chair, or didn't appoint, we elected, but Trump, you know, endorsed and selected Michael Whatley as chair, and Laura Trump. And, you know, I know Michael for a while. I think he's going to do a great job.
Yeah.
But the RNC, changing the RNC is going to require a lot more than just changing the chair.
Yeah.
We need committee men who are also devoted to making the RNC more conservative, more bold, more principled, and I think Debbie Georgiatos will do that.
So there are three members on the RNC from Texas. It's the committee woman, the committee man, and the chair. All serve on the RNC, correct?
Yeah. Yes. And me and Robin Armstrong's the committee man.
Yes.
He's a tremendous committee man. He's been on there longer than I have and is really the example of how a conservative should operate on the RNC. He's been doing great.
No, I think you're right. Robin's done a great job. Yeah. Anything in closing that you feel like is important for delegates, alternates, even people who voted for you to know about your tenure as chair of the Republican Party of Texas?
Yeah. So what we've done seems obvious to everybody who's coming to convention. Like, yeah, the party should stick up for principles.
Yep.
People really don't understand how extraordinary it is. It's something that really we haven't even seen in our country in the past 50 years. And we're doing it here in our largest red state. Mm-hmm. A party that's, again, asserting an adherence to principle and making it mean something. And we are starting a movement here in Texas that's spreading to other states. I know we've seen it spring up in like Arizona to some extent. But I remember my friend Evan, who's chair of the Florida GOP, got a notification from him a couple months ago. It's like, we adopted, as Florida didn't even have a platform. Mm. Okay. They said, we adopted legislative priorities for the first time. And they adopted 10 legislative priorities. They picked specific bills and they were advocating for them. And that's the second largest red state in the country. And they said they did it because we saw what happened in Texas and what you guys did with the party. That's important. It's spreading. Other states are doing this now because they're seeing the way that our party's working. And as it spreads across the country, right, we are going to see the special interests have less influence, the parties having more, and candidates will be guided more by principle and will have a better republic because of it.
Yeah.
So when people go to convention, again, look for those buzzwords of people who don't like that.
Yeah.
It's like, we have to go back to basics, or we have to, you know, go back to winning elections. And we're always winning elections. No, it means you don't want to do all of these things that we did to empower the grassroots instead of special interests.
A friend of mine announced he was running for SREC, and I won't call him out by name right now, but he in his announcement, he said, I've been here for a long time, and so I think we can champion the grassroots and get along with and work and coordinate with public officials. We don't have to only do one. And I was like, first of all, this statement acts like somebody's just doing one of these, right? And so it's like, that's just a weird platform. So I said, well, what are you going to do if some Republicans are going against our platform? Of course, he didn't answer. But it was like, and I know this guy, I respect him, I've known him for a long time, but it's going, hey, what are you talking about? You know, like we literally get along with a lot of these Republicans. There's a handful we don't, which makes it sound like you're saying, I need to get along with every single Republican and be with the grassroots. And that doesn't happen.
It's impossible to. That's wonderful. It's like unicorn land, right?
I've gotten calls from people across the country, vice chairs of GOPs, mm-hmm. County chairs going, hey, can you send me some of these talking points? Can you send me what you're doing? Can you put us in touch? I've even had put people in touch with you. Can you put me in touch with Matt Rinaldi? Because we have a chair who actually said he wants to do some of these things. He doesn't even know what it looks like. Mm-hmm. So I think people don't understand the level at which other state parties are actually turning around. I remember there was this live tweeting going on of like the Nebraska GOP convention a couple of years ago. And I'm seeing all these tweets and they're like, oh my gosh, the chair is getting ousted. This conservative is taking over. This is happening. This is chaos. This is crazy. The conservatives have taken over. The grassroots are rising. So I'm looking up like how many people go to a Nebraska state GOP convention?
It's not a lot.
It's like 1,000 people. And at my SD convention in Bexar County, which we're like a Democrat district, to be honest, and we had 350, 400 people. I mean, some of these SDs have 800 people at just the SD. And you're thinking, man, this revolutionizing of the Republican Party in this entire state is being done by 1,000 people. People are going to show up in a couple of weeks to San Antonio and it's going to be the largest political gathering, you know, in the nation. So there's nothing in comparison to it. There's nothing like a Republican state convention. Matt, I really appreciate the 3 years that you have dedicated to helping shift the GOP in a positive way. I think Alan West actually made a lot of positive movements during his time as chair, but I think you took it to a whole nother level. No offense to Alan, who's now the Dallas GOP chair and hopefully will do a great job there. But I think that this period of time that we can look at, 4 years, 3 years specifically, is remarkable. I'm really grateful that you've been willing to serve as you have.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Do you want to get your news from people who share your values? Texas Scorecard. Real news for real Texans.